Can I welcome you all to the Audit Committee? We have apologies from Mike Ramsey, who's abroad, and from Councillor Parry. Order of business, are there any additional items? You should all have two supplementary papers. They're the interim audit account report on the Delivering Excellence Programme and on revenue financial budget monitoring. Declarations of interest, which can be made at any time during the meeting, there being none. We move to the minutes of 11th December. Are there any comments on the minutes? These are therefore adopted. Thank you very much. The action log.
Sorry, Chair. Just in relation to item 5.8 on the minute, if you wouldn't mind. This related to the internal audit mid-term performance report 2018-19, where we asked for approval of the audit committee to defer some pieces of work. Now looking at the programme to the end of March with the resources within the team, is proposed to, in addition, defer another piece of work, ICT operational processes. We've got another piece of work within this quarter on ICT security. So the idea in discussions with management is to smooth some of our audit activity relating to ICT across the years, and you'll see this when we present a draft plan for internal audit work to the meeting of this committee in March, so really for information.
Okay, so that's a request for further deferrals, and the subject matter is found on page 11 in the minutes of the previous meeting. Are we content for these further deferrals? We probably don't have any alternative. Thank you. Action log, page 15. Jill, have you any comments on the action log?
No, I think it reflects plans and activity in some of the agenda items today.
We've just had the briefing. Thank you. We move now to item 5.1, Audit Scotland Report on Local Government in Scotland. Gary.
Thanks, Chair. Members will recollect that the last audit committee we brought the recently published first of the two overview reports from Audit Scotland directly to Audit Committee, just really giving the key messages that were in those reports. And the timeliness in terms of Audit Committee considering that alongside the annual report from colleagues from EY. We've now brought the report back again. There was a link to it within the report, and really what we've done is just gone through the report and put a Midlothian context onto it. So the report sets out the background, and the first of the Audit Scotland reports really focuses on financial matters. We'll see another report published, my understanding the delivery deadline for that is the 14th of March, which will be more around performance and outcomes. We move to section 2.6, the report sets out key messages, and I suppose the messages that members will be familiar with, the reliance on government funding, and the reduction in government funding that councils are seeing. The councils have been managing to manage funding gaps, and mainly through savings and some planned use of reserves, and the pressure that councils are under to balance books. As a result, the increase in spending on education and social work, which are offset by reductions elsewhere, And as you go through the 1920 budget, you will see that exacerbated. 18 councils with low level of reserve, just reinforcing the acute financial challenge, and the reference to it in terms of where councils are in terms of the IJBs and the increasing funding for flowing through IJBs. Interestingly, across the country, the position with IJBs differs, and Audit Scotland saying the majority have financial sustainability issues, 20 incurring deficits, and indeed I think some IJBs sit with negative reserves, although I've not quite got my head around what that means. And I think that the bottom of page 18 of the agenda, the financial outlook has turned since the report was published into reality in terms of continued reductions in grant funding, and members will be aware of the 2.4% or £237 million cut in the local government budget that the 12th of December budget brought for councils. In terms of the section 3, it goes through each part of the report and highlights at the bottom of each section the key messages for Midlothian. And in terms of the council's budgets and spending, those messages reflect the challenges Midlothian faces when it set the 17-18 budget. The 17-18 budget for us included measures of over £12 million to address the shortfall. And of that £12 million, £3.9 million of reserves was committed by the administration. In terms of the budget, we showed a small net overspend in 17-18 on the revenue account of £622,000. The challenges continue in the current financial year and will continue in 19-20. In terms of the Council's financial position, part two, key messages, again, reflects exactly the messages that the Council faces. The resources available continue to reduce both cash and real terms, and it reinforces the robustness that we need around the budget setting process as we go through the next few weeks. I suppose Midlothian is in that unique position with the highest growing authority, 13% growth projected over the period to 26, that we've got that continued requirement to invest to support our growing population, so that brings an added level of difficulty. And that, as we touched on at the earlier session, as we'll see in the Treasury paper, the need to borrow to fund those capital investments. We know it's going to be difficult going forward, and the report highlights the need to be proactive and move forward. In terms of integration, joint boards, I think Midlothian position probably better than some. The IJB finished the year with a small reserve to carry forward, but it's got significant financial challenges given the demand for services and the unmet demand within the system. The outlook, we all know what the settlement brought in December, a very challenging, very acute financial position with the cut to core funding. We projected back in December a budget shortfall, so the difference between the money we need to deliver what we're delivering and the money we'll have of £9.591 million. I'll be reporting to Council on the 12th of February that now sits at £11.5 million. That is an impact of the actual settlement, an impact of the recent pay awards, which have increased our costs, a change in where we expect the position to be with funding of teachers' pension increases, to name but a few of the pressures that are coming through the system. So a very acute financial position. That's an £11 million shortfall against a £213 million budget. So the process of determining the 19-20 budget is going to be very challenging. And it reinforces then the need to immediately to move to a sustainable medium-term financial strategy so that we get out of the short-term setting budgets in February and then trying to implement for the April, really moving towards having a four-year plan to address the projected financial gaps. So that's the sort of key messages. Really, the report is there for Audit Committee's consideration and this report for noting. Within the Audit Scotland report, it was well laid out, and if I recollect, it's down the right-hand side of each page. There's blue text, which sets a number of questions for councillors and members of Audit Committee to consider, and happy to run through any of those questions today or any aspect of the report. Thanks.
Thank you, Gary. So this figure, the cut to core services of 2.4%, which has been much in our minds, partly because of COSLA, in fact, it's an underestimate because of these additional negative variances that have occurred since, such as unfunded pensions for teachers, the teachers' pay increase, unfunded general increases in remuneration in local authorities. Is there anything else that we need to take notice of?
No, so I suppose the 2.4% cut was on the where we are at the moment, the 18-19 settlement, and 18-19 was described as a cash flat settlement. So you've got your core funding going down 2.4% at the same time as your cost base is going up, and our predominant cost is salaries and wages going up. 3% is the offers that are on the table for 19-20. So you can see why that budget shortfall arises. Income going down, costs going up.
Has anyone calculated what that 2.4% figure should rise to if we took into account everything else that's coming down the tracks?
My recollection, COSLA published a paper back, I think, in late October, November, a fair funding paper, and I think it was, you know, you were over £500 million that needed to go into local government to just stand still. I can't remember the exact figure, I've got so many numbers in my head, but it was over £500 million across Scotland.
So that £237 million that relates to 2.4, that's now £500 million. So we're really looking at nearly 5%.
So say that the five hundred million pounds was what local government thought it would need to stand still. And that's before you factor in the new policy commitments, early years, additional funding for IGBs, etc., that government have mainly ring-fenced in the proposed settlement.
Can I ask my ritual question every time I see Alistair? With the £20 billion settlement for the NHS nationally, how much of that is liable to come to Scotland and therefore to come down to our IJB?
That's a question that I would need to ask my Director of Finance. I'm happy to take that question away, but it's certainly not a question that I'm being privy to, an answer that I'm being privy to.
Okay, so that's small positive factors yet to be determined. Peter Devink.
Am I correct that Midlothian is roughly 1% of the total of the Scottish Council? So if there is 500 million of a requirement, we would then require roughly 5%, 5 million if we were just 1%. Is that correct?
We're on average about, we equate about one, just short of 1.7% of Scotland, so it would be pushing towards the £8 million.
Derek.
Yeah, it gives for grim reading when you read through some of this. You just think to yourself, well, did you need to write a report to tell us this? I think we're now past. I mean, we have what's called the Delivering Excellence Programme. I think we're as well dropping that word excellence, and I think we should just change it to delivering a minimum of the statutory services and getting rid of anything else other than statutory services, because the budget cuts are of such that there will be no scope here for us at all if they continue along the line. We're now looking at £11.5 million a budget gap between what we deliver, which is over 5%. We're talking about delivering services better and more efficiently. That's a certainty, that's what we're going to have to do. But we're going to have to vastly reduce the services that are on offer out there if this isn't addressed. We do talk about it, Gary, and I take your point, and we're working as hard as we can to look to see about setting a four-year budget settlement, but it's really, really difficult to look at that and say, well, is this really, are we going to really end up, surely we can end up with £40-odd million less? I think there's a disbelief with the public, probably with a lot of senior officers and members as well, that this can continue, or else you are actually going to be down to your basic statutory services and delivering nothing else. It's absolutely horrendous.
Gary.
Just to expand on that point, just remind members that the Scottish Government, the Cabinet Secretary, produced the first medium-term financial strategy. I think it was 31st of May last year. And I know that in terms of correspondence that's gone from this Council to the Cabinet Secretary about the budget, he has come back and referenced that the extent of the challenge shouldn't be new, you shouldn't have been incited on it, because it really was reflected in his medium-term financial strategy. So for the when Councillor Milligan quotes the £41 million, that's our projections out to 22-23 based on a continuation assumption of a 2% cut each year in grant funding. And that's based on our interpretation of Scottish Government's medium-term financial strategy, I'm afraid. That does call into question the sustainability of councils in their current form and what councils can deliver. It's a challenge that everybody's acutely aware of.
The issue arises as whether or not the Scottish Government will produce a slightly more generous settlement, as happened last year, and I understand the key dates for that are the 6th of February and then the 23rd of February. We meet again on the 12th of February, so we're going to have to probably sail into very severe cuts before we finally know if the Scottish Government is prepared to be more supportive.
You will outline the timeline, but the parliamentary process sees the stage one debate on Thursday and then goes to the committee stage, the stage two, on the 6th of February, with the final stage back in Parliament and the Chamber on the 21st. There's a really good article in the BBC last night I read, just outlining what happens at each stage of the parliamentary process. It was enlightening, because I didn't know the answers to some of those questions. So a key vote on Thursday that the government have to get their budget, have to get a vote at stage one to allow it to go to committee. So we'll keep. I'll update members on the 12th of February when council meets on where the parliamentary process has got us to. But government either need people to vote with them on the budget or people to abstain to allow the budget to pass through the parliamentary process. It's very fluid. I'm not cited on there being any intelligence to suggest that we could rely on a further cash injection, although other parties are acutely aware through the lobbying that COSLA and others have done of, and indeed elected members here directly with members of other parties, the acute financial position for local authorities and the need to get more money into the system.
My thoughts are really logistical. Are we liable as a council to be having our extremely unpleasant cuts meeting before we finally know what the Scottish Government could do for us? And maybe there will be a case, not necessarily to be decided today, for having a separate budget meeting for Midlothian once the Scottish Government process is finalised, and of course before the statutory period where we have to create our balanced budget.
I think that's a position. We wait to see where we are on the 12th of February.
But right now, all the parties need to consider their budgets as reflecting that £11 million deficit or the £9.5 million deficit.
So the shortfall that will need to be addressed to achieve a balanced budget based on the budget as it stands from Scottish Government, the grant settlement from Scottish Government, is £11.522 million. That's the figure I expect to publish in the council papers for the 12th of February.
And the officers' proposals will relate to that £11.5 million gap.
So what we'll bring forward in terms of officers recognising the need to give members options to balance the budget is a set of measures. I wouldn't call them proposals, a set of measures that look at the severity of the settlement, what it means for the delivery of non-statutory services and what reductions are required in statutory services to achieve financial balance.
I think the point you make, Peter, is very valid here, that we might be in a position on the 12th of February that we're not completely clear on what the position is. That brings itself a lot of challenges, because we have a billing system that we really need to be out for the first week in March, or it misses the first run, even though the statutory date, I think, is the 11th of March for the date. But to make sure balls land on doorsteps in time, really the end of February is the latest we can get. I think the one thing that we're all certain is that it'll either be £11.5 million or it'll not be far short. £11.5 million that we're going to have to save, and I would expect that the officers will come back with their proposals, and I would have expected each of the political groups, as we agreed at the December meeting, to feed into that and to bring forward their own proposals. So is it what's on the table? Isn't it something that we're all tabling on the day? So is it if we're going to work with the officers to make sure that everything's thought about, went thought through, so is it everything that can be considered that doesn't take for a frontline service is done? So I would hope that each of the political groups are feeding in with the officers and where their proposals are.
So on the basis of our expectations, we need to continue full steam ahead to cover the gap as we know it at the moment. If there happen to be some slightly better news later, I'm no doubt we'll find plenty of claims on the excess that would occur. Councillor Muirhead.
That said, we know that in future years we're going to have even bigger problems. So even if we're in a situation where there's some kind of injection before we make a decision, we need to bear in mind that we've still got problems ahead. And, you know, I think we've said this a number of times, if there's something that we know we maybe didn't need to cut this year, but it's going to be cut next year, we're as well doing it now. I think we need to keep that, bear that in mind when we're discussing that sort of thing.
Okay, so we continue with the existing timetable, notwithstanding that the Scottish Government may not have finalised their own deliberations. Thank you. Jill.
Thank you, Chair. Just in addition to the cover report, which indicates that the officers have considered the local government overview report, in addition to the publication from the Accounts Commission, there's actually some supplements that are published on the Audit Scotland website, one of which is a scrutiny tool for councillors, and it suggests that it's something that councillors may wish to consider in light of the council's acute financial position and enabling some of the scrutinising of the financial performance. So I think there's a number of different tools, as well as some pretty stark key messages within the report itself. So it's something worth considering, in particular for the members of the Audit Committee.
And the link to the scrutiny tool is within the report?
Yes, thank if you go onto the Audit Scotland website, the link's there.
Thank you all. I will now move to item 5.2, the internal audit report on payroll. Jill.
Thank you, Chair. So this payroll audit focused on the key controls associated with the Council's starters and leavers process, some key areas of risk. So there are a number of good, effective controls to provide substantial assurance to management and the Audit Committee, and some examples of good practice that are listed in the report. We identified that there were areas of improvement, and we've made four medium-rated recommendations relating to monitoring the service compliance with the process to make sure that the timely receipt of notifications documented some of the stated practice, some aspects around record-keeping and data quality checking. I'm pleased to report that since the final report was issued to management, the two improvement actions due by the end of December 2018 have been implemented, and plans are in place to implement the remaining one recommendation by its due date of the 31st of March 2019. So hopefully this provides some positive assurance around some key control areas.
Thank you. So we're pretty sure we're not paying former staff who've left the employment of the council.
Yeah, reasonable assurance in relation to that. So we checked the overarching process. I mean, obviously, we can't give you absolute assurance because it's based on some test samples. And you'll recall through the EY's annual audit report, there was one instance in terms of lever that was detected through some of their external audit work. So we've done some additional sample testing to provide that positive assurance.
Thank you. Other comments? Thank you again, and we move on to item 5.3, the Internal Audit Recommendations Progress Report. Jill.
Yeah, so this is one of our regular progress reports on the implementation of internal audit recommendations to the committee, that certainly in terms of the comparison with previous year's reports, we have seen an improvement in terms of implementation. However, there are still some long-standing actions there, and there are some actions that are, you know, have not seen the progress that we would expect. The discussions with some of the directors and heads of service and with some support from the performance management teams, they have indicated in there about setting out some realistic dates. So what we're asking the audit committee to endorse is those revised due dates to enable those relevant officers to implement the actions in full. In addition, there are some enhancements to the processes and practices that are in place. So as part of the routine monitoring, the directors and heads of service now receive some reports on the internal audit recommendations. So there's more, hopefully more sight, so we'll start to see a trend of further improvement. Internal audit will continue as part of its follow-up process to monitor the progress in relation to implementation, and we'll make some comments in the internal audit annual assurance report that will be brought to this committee in May-June time.
Thank you. In terms of the performance of internal audit, I recall that we have an arrangement that staff from another local authority inspect us from time to time. Could you update us on where that process is?
So within the internal audit midterm performance report that was presented to this committee in December, we stated the obligations which are set out in the local government accounts regulations and in accordance with the public sector internal audit standards. It sets out that we carry out an annual self-assessment, which we've done each year, and we state that in our annual assurance reports, and indeed for the first time we've had the midterm performance monitoring report. Every 5 years, as part of the public sector internal audit standards, there's a requirement for an external quality assessment. This was carried out in March 2018 by Highland Council. We reported in our annual assurance report for 17-18 that it was fairly positive. There were some areas of improvement. We reported some of the progress in relation to implementing those improvements in our midterm performance monitoring report to this committee in December. And again, we'll include that part of the process as part of our annual assurance report for 18-19. And that would give some comfort both to management and indeed to the audit committee around our kind of professional quality standards within their internal audit service provision.
And you shared that Highland report with Ernst & Young?
Sorry, the report was included in published papers for the audit committee?
Sure.
And you might recall, Chair, that we commented on the independent feedback from Highland in our annual audit report in relation to internal audit, so we have seen that.
Okay. Any questions? Item 5.4, the report on revenue financial budget monitoring.
So just by way of background for members of the audit committee, when we were developing the audit plan for 18-19, we were cited on the EY annual audit report 16-17, and in light of the financial position of the council and the underpinning transformation and change programme, we included two pieces of work, so one on the Delivering Excellence programme and one on the revenue budget monitoring process, so from setting around monitoring and delivery and the financial information. So these audits have been completed in accordance with that plan due to the importance of the underlying issues and the timeliness of considering the subject matter. These reports are inextricably linked in their content, their findings and their recommendations, and they were issued to management together as well as on today's audit committee agenda. So the findings in relation to revenue budget monitoring indicate that whilst the systems of internal control and governance for financial management and the change programme are in place, there are indications in there that these are not operating satisfactorily. The component parts of the budget setting and budget monitoring and reporting processes for core service delivery and business change need to be enhanced to ensure they are robust and effective. In particular, in these times of reducing government funding, as we've mentioned, the rapid pace of change arising from additional legislative and policy obligations, and indeed the increased population growth within the Midlothian area. The recommendations within the report, some of which are consistent with the roles raised by EY in their annual audit reports in 16-17 and 17-18, they are more detailed in their nature and they're designed to assist Midlothian Council with some continuous improvements to its financial management arrangements and ongoing financial sustainability. The recommendations relate to required improvements across the whole system, i.e. officers and members in terms of budget setting responsibilities, officers in terms of delivery within policy and budget during the year, and members' scrutiny and challenging of that delivery, and indeed the quality of the financial information underpinning these processes for officers and members. These reports have been discussed in advance with senior management in various forums in a very constructive way, and a commitment was made to address the areas of improvement as a collective team. And I note that some progress has been made on some of the actions, in particular as part of the budget setting process for 2019-20 and beyond. And the management responses are included in the action plan within the report. So in summary, the previous systems of internal control and governance for financial management were adequate for the previous local government operating environment. We're concluding that they require refinement to fit with the current and future context of severe financial constraints and service demand. So we're asking the audit committee to review the content of the audit report, endorse the agreed audit recommendations and note the steps that management has already taken to progress the areas of improvement.
Thank you. I think we're all painfully conscious that the business transformation savings that the council has been penciling in for many years have struggled to be achieved. But playing devil's advocate, we ended the last financial year with a negative variance of only 622,000, all of which you could attribute, if you wanted, to the beast from the east. So there does appear to be some internal robustness in the reporting function within this council.
I think there's a danger in all financial reports just looking at the bottom line figure. You need to look at, you know, the various component parts that gave rise to that 622 overspend, net overspend. So there were demand-led pressures within service, shortfalls in achieving savings targets, offset by additional council tax income, some grant funding, and we'll touch on it later, but my recollection in the years we had an underspend on Treasury. So it's really getting behind that headline number to look at, you know, the variations across the services, and particularly those variations that have got where there is an underlying pressure that could continue into later financial years. So some of the service demand-led pressures are there and will continue, but they're offset by one-off items in terms of compensating savings or compensating underspends. So it's really getting into that nitty-gritty. And I would encourage members to do that as the quarter three report comes up to council on 12th February.
Derek, Jill, ladies first.
Just in terms of clarification, so there were some elements over the previous years around the budget setting process, which was approval to the utilisation of reserves. Over and above that, there were net overspends that resulted in utilisation of reserves. So whilst in terms of some years, it might have appeared to be a small overspend on the approved budgets, actually the decisions had already been made in the budget setting process to utilise reserves, which were diminishing over the years. So it's looking at that kind of wider financial sustainability of the council as a whole.
So the result was quite close last year, but actually on the basis of an unsustainable model. Yes, I think we can all agree that. I mean, more specific areas we've always taken interest in is voluntary severance. Were you aware of any drift there that we're not getting the payback on voluntary severance? The problem is often that you let people go who get the early retirement and all that good stuff, and it appears that you're making a saving, but then you actually have to hire more folk back in.
So in terms of the monitoring reports, we've given an update to council, and I'm sure the last one we were looking at an average payback about 1 year. Our policy is quite clear in terms of voluntary severance. Once a post is deleted from the establishment through voluntary severance, it doesn't go back in. So there should not be that creep in terms of cost posts coming back in. And indeed, as staff leave the council, we've got very severe restrictions in terms of their ability to return to employment within the council within a set period, or indeed long term. So I'm relatively comfortable that there should be no backtracking on those savings that have come and the investment, because we've invested money through VSER to secure those savings.
Councillor Milligan.
I think I take Gary's point, your point, that it was a small £600,000 overspend, but the reality is, Jill's 100% right in this, that we've continued to set some budgets that are unrealistic. We'll take, for example, children's services, which is pressure-led. It was quite clear that when you look back on it now, that they were struggling to deliver the service within budget, and we were simply setting them new targets to make efficiencies, and somewhere you've just got to draw the line and say, that's unrealistic, it's okay, it'll get us a balanced budget at the start of the year, but at the end of the year it will again be overspent, and we can't do that. If we know fine well it's no, that then we need to make sure that the budgets are realistic budgets, and I think that's saying it's there. the part we're talking about the utilisation of reserves, I think, was just under £4 million, and yet we still came in slightly overspent again, I think. And it's right, that was the last administration, and it's something that should never happen again. It was warned at the time that it wasn't the right steps to take, so we need to we need to do that. The one area where and I'm not sure where Jill's alluding to here, where she talks about members fail to challenge, there's no evidence of a robust challenge here for elected members. I'm unsure of what she means by that.
As part of the audit process, I think we're quite clear within the report that due to trying to expedite this piece of work to try and get to some identifying some areas, the areas of improvement and some solutions, and having those discussions with managers as part of the audit process, we didn't meet with any of the members. So I just want to be absolutely clear in terms of that. What we were relying on were the minutes in terms of meetings and things. So if that scrutiny and challenge is not coming through the minuting process, and maybe there's something that we can try and do just to emphasise that. So it's a it was a comment based on what documentation we looked at as part of the audit process. It's not to say that there isn't any scrutiny, but I think what the key messages in terms of this report is that because of the acute financial position, and we're seeing it demonstrated here in this forum today, is that scrutiny and challenge is required even more so than in previous years. So I think subject to the limitations in terms of the audit process, ordinarily we would have met with a number of the elected members as well, but time didn't permit. We wanted to try and get these pieces of work to be completed and land to try and help with the budget setting programme for 1920 and beyond. So it's the comments are limited to the documentation that we did have access to.
Councillor Milligan.
I think that's where the problem arises for me. I'm aware other political groups done the same. We had several away days with the officers. We met with every head of department along with their managers to go through line by line what the budget proposals were, to seek assurances, and we're given the assurances, by the way, in some of the areas that failed. And a crying new example is the lifeguards, for example, that the saving couldn't be. We actually asked the questions there. Was there any health and safety issues there? Was there anything? Now, we met and went through every single line, not on one occasion, on several occasions. Once we had put aside stuff, we had questions on some areas of savings, and I'm not sure what we need to then do to make sure that when audit reports like this are being written, that's taken into account. Because, and I take the point you're getting, Jill, as if it's not a minuted meeting, how do you then know that's there? Well, the very work of politics, there are numerous meetings where political groups are meeting with officers on a regular basis to challenge these issues, to get further information and to be able to come forward with alternatives if they're not happy with what the officers are doing. And I would have thought that there would have been some note taken in these discussions that would have been available to auditors, and I'm not sure if the Chief Executive can throw any light on this, but I would have hoped that would be available, because when you read this, it's quite simply like elected members have sat and nodded stuff through and we've no challenged it. And the reality is that's not true. I'm aware the SNP group have had several away days, and when they were in administration had regular away days with officers and that as well. And it's how do we get that in when audits such as this are being done?
Grace.
I think there's also a comment just about delivering on it, Derek. So I think a good example that was shown was at the end of quarter one when we made the decision to implement the recovery plans, and then the challenge that came there at October Council, and how that then moved on, and then that changed the position in quarter two. So certainly over the last few council meetings, we've certainly had a lot of scrutiny around that and people making clear that we deliver on it. So I think that gives us good indications of how we need to be moving forward. So it's not just about the setting of the budget, it's actually delivering it within budget each quarter and making sure that we're not bringing up reports to council that report an underspend. So we've already gone through the Q3, although we're still predicting a slight overspend there, it's the mitigating actions that we're putting in place to make sure that by the end of the year that we're delivering either a zero or an underspend. But it needs to be part and parcel of our everyday working, so not just the conversations before the budget setting, but at the budget setting and all through the year, because the deliverology is really, really vital.
Jill.
Thank you. And as part of the discussions with management in terms of these reports, they've asked us to, and have referred to it in the report, asked us to include a piece of work within our audit plan for 1920, following this through. It's a really kind of critical, fundamental part in terms of the financial management and sustainability. So as part of that process, and if we can plan early enough, we'll look at the whole system in terms of looking at those wider aspects. As I say, this was a very narrow element in terms of looking at some of the documentation, and it will give us an opportunity to look at those wider elements and bring those into the context of what the whole system is. So hopefully that gives some comfort around the process. But it really was to try and get these pieces of work done, and the messages out there, and actually we can see some of the changes happening through the process. We just need to make sure that those continue going forward.
Yeah, that would be helpful, Joel. Obviously, anything that you can assist elected members in making sure that there's a robust challenge there. If there is anything you think we could be doing more, we're quite happy to take that. But I would like to find a way to make sure that information, such as political group meetings with officers and that, we need to find a way to make sure that's in the arena that auditors, external and internal, can get out of that. However, the basis of this we need to just really accept is effectively that over the last period of time the budgets have been unrealistic and haven't been long enough sighted, and we need to actually start delivering on them.
And that's one of the very constructive conversations that we've had with the corporate management team, and them looking at that kind of longer time horizon and developing a medium-term financial strategy to try and kind of facilitate that, and recognising that it probably is now a continuous process in terms of monitoring the delivery, having more kind of timely financial information, and having that as part, really changing the whole culture in terms of how that is done. Some of those traditional methods clearly, in the context that we're now operating, within. Are not working for us. So to me, I think it's about the really kind of positive engagement on yes, we need to improve, and there's some steps underway to try and address that. So through 1920, we'll continue to do some pieces of internal audit work to hopefully be able to evidence the governance and all the different elements in terms of your internal controls are starting to operate effectively, and in due course we'll bring those reports back to this committee.
Thank you. Councillor Muirhead.
Yeah, and I 3.5, it talks about a number of users expressing doubts about the completeness and accuracy of budget information provided to them. I take it we're talking, when we talk about users there, we're actually talking about staff, senior staff, as opposed to elected members, because certainly my view is that it's actually much more critical that we have timeous and accurate information for management, more so than elected members, because they're the ones that have the ability to actually affect the change and to react to issues that arise that have financial implications all through the year. Can I ask, just is that what we were talking about there when we talk about users? Is that kind of the level?
We're actually talking about both, but one of the recommendations kind of sets out the kind of expectation of the information requirements. So there are different information requirements for the officers in terms of budget holders, but indeed you as elected members, in terms of your role, you require good quality financial information, so that indeed you can scrutinise and monitor the delivery. So one of the actions, 5.6, talks about ascertain those finance information needs to fulfil different roles and responsibilities. So, and we had a really constructive discussion with Head of Finance and Integrated Support Services and the Financial Services Manager around that action. So I think that's entirely possible.
Thank you. We move on now to the review of the Delivering Excellence Programme, item 5.5. Jill?
So, connected in terms of the previous internal audit report around the budget setting and revenue budget monitoring, the Delivering Excellence Programme was quite key in terms of underpinning the budgets that have been approved and thus are inextricably linked to the financial information and the monitoring and review. So in conclusion, again, in terms of the Delivering Excellence programme, it had delivered savings in some areas. In recent years, it's not delivered the cost savings and efficiencies consistently across all the service areas in order to secure ongoing financial sustainability. There's a kind of key element to the governance in place. So again, in terms of the internal financial controls and governance, those with the Business Transformation Board and indeed the Business Transformation Steering Group. So all the kind of elements in terms of the governance are there. Again, the recommendations set out some of the enhancements to those to make them operate more effectively. So similar comment around the revenue budget monitoring. It is the whole system in relation to that we're looking about improvement. And an observation that there was quite a lot of detailed monitoring information around some service-specific change and transformation, which is absolutely essential, but it really needs to be repositioned. So we're looking at those cross-cutting change and transformation elements of the programme and put that higher level of governance around those more significant areas of risk for the council, but have some other monitoring mechanisms that ensure that some service-specific change and transformation is also being delivered. So in essence, those are some of the kind of key conclusions around the Delivering Excellence programme, and we've got four high-rated recommendations around that, again linked to the proposed medium-term financial strategy. And specifically, in terms of the governance framework, looking at the scrutiny role that Business Transformation Board has to revert back to a benefit realisation and outcomes model that was previously used. So if that is refocused onto those higher risk and more significant transformation, then looking at the monitoring of the benefits realisation and outcomes associated with that, and hopefully that will be more effective around clarifying the roles and responsibilities of all the budget holders and the change leaders within the council and as well as elected members and those that are members of the Business Transformation Steering Group to gain assurance that all those improved mechanisms are in place, and it's those elements that should hopefully, if they all kind of combine, actually enhance the governance framework and ensure that there's more rigorous monitoring.
Thank you. So there's a stress here on cross-cutting, and there's a stress on going back to benefits realisation and outcomes. I'm not a member of this committee, at least haven't been until quite recently. What was it that we were attempting to measure against before? I would have thought that all the work of the relevant committee must have included some outcomes and some benefits being assessed. Or were people just talking in the ether about generalities?
The more recent forecast in light of the financial position that the council was in, it tended to be more focused on some of the cost-cutting elements. So perhaps as part of that, not looking kind of widely across in terms of that kind of the cross-cutting and looking at delivering services in quite different way. So it's a proportionate to the risks and the expectations around your return on the investment around some of these change programmes, but not just the delivery of the efficiency savings in terms of benefit realisation. It's looking wider around your customer experience. You know, there's maybe in terms of community engagement aspects around your change and transformation. It's a mechanism to try and capture those wider business benefits, and it's those elements that really underpin the council's duty in terms of best value. So it's not just the financial management element, it's all the different aspects in terms of benefit realisation and outcomes. And if you set those at the start through robust business cases, we should at least have some sense of what might that look like and set out expected benefits and outcomes, and then some milestones and monitoring during those programmes. More likely they'll take a number of years to come to fruition. Some are shorter term, but it's a slightly different focus than purely the financial savings aspects.
Yeah, thanks. I mean, we are of course driven very narrowly to financial savings at the moment, and you seem to be suggesting here a more holistic approach to assessing the outcomes. Isn't there a tension between the financial aims of the council at the moment and that wider cost benefit approach that you're suggesting?
I mean, there will always be demands in relation to that, but the council has a duty in terms of being able to demonstrate best value, and we're about to be reviewed as part of best value assurance review. So as part of that, it is the kind of combination of what's set out in the single Midlothian plan, the ambitions associated with that, and whilst we kind of recognise that some of those will be constrained by the funding that is available to the council. So yes, there will be very difficult decisions. I mean, not underestimating this, But actually some of the conversations from a management perspective around the medium-term financial strategy is exploring those wider elements about how it interconnects into other aspects like the workforce strategy and your asset and infrastructure investments going forward and the community engagement aspect in terms of delivering services in a slightly different way. So, yes, it's not underestimating the financial challenge that exists, but it's just a slightly different focus.
Grace.
One practical example of a cross-cutting theme that we've been looking at, which we discussed at the last Business Transformation Steering Group, was automation and how that can actually help us to continue to deliver some services, but in a different way. And it also cuts down on the amount of monitoring that we need to do, because actually all of the monitoring is inbuilt from the beginning. So we've got another automation workshop on the 6th of February in the hope that that drastically informs our medium-term financial strategy. It's not the only option, but it needs to be a really important key lever for us, I think, moving forward.
Councillor Muirhead.
I know in 3.2 on the paper here, it says, based upon a sample of higher value components that we examined within the programme, not all proposals were well thought out, well planned, may not ultimately be deliverable if, in fact, they ever were deliverable. This is kind of, shutting the door after the horse is bolted, because, you know, we're getting audit looking at that now. How can we improve the information that's available to us when we make these decisions? Because, you know, we're the best one in the world. Officers are trying to put together a series of recommendations to allow us to close the gaps in our financial position. As relatively speaking layman, how do we get the tools and the skills to be able to question the experts in effect that are coming forward and saying we can save a certain amount of money by doing this? How do we get the kind of check that you've carried out in retrospect available to us before we make the decisions about accepting certain proposals that come forward for the officers, because they're desperately trying to put together a budget that allows them to deliver service within these financial constraints, and they're coming forward sometimes with money raising options that we might have a gut feeling that are they deliverable, but we're relying on the specialists and the experts to advise us, yes, these are deliverable. How do we get the tools to question that?
Yeah, that's, I think, a powerful question, because we as councillors do not have operational responsibility. It's very clearly laid down. Councillor Muirhead, Councillor Milligan.
Yeah, it's just to echo Jim's question there, because I think we need to get a way to get that answer, because if you look at the last budget setting process, all of a sudden that word entrepreneurial councillor came in. And we challenged that very robustly and were assured that the figures set there were figures that were very achievable. How, as laymen, do we stand and argue with a professional officer who's been doing the job for 30 years, who's given us an assurance that's here? Because there was some of the stuff we looked at and you just thought, that has to be pie in the sky. And it turned out to be, and it's back to the point in areas where we have challenged, where we've sort of even asked the pertinent questions on health and safety grounds, where we've been given assurances that these things had all been looked at. And as I understand it, as proposals were put forward, they weren't just challenged. Remember, they were challenged by the peers through the corporate management team. So, if other professionals can't find a way of putting a hole in that, how does the elected member?
Grace, I think I'll let you handle that.
I think you were right to identify the entrepreneurial theme, and that's one that we've been looking at more closely. Gary's certainly done a lot of work over the last wee while stripping out anything that's been unrealistic, which is why we were getting to the point of requiring the recovery plans. But equally, Gary was quite clear about the Green Book standard around anything. So we need really clear business plans moving forward, but also not to overestimate what you might manage to take in year one or year two. So that work that's been ongoing, I think, for the last 6 months, Gary stripping that out, has been a really important piece of work. Actually, with hindsight, it would have been better if that had happened before, but we are where we are, and I think it's really important that we very much robustly go through that and question that. And I'm all for it being evidence-based practice, so if we do not have the evidence to back up that convinces us, we need to be saying that we're not convinced that that is actually going to deliver it. But if you look at the entrepreneurial theme, that is the very area where we're seeing a significant overspend when we bring the quarter three report back up. So we've actually over recovered in a number of other areas in the council, but what that's actually doing is it's almost offsetting the significant overspend in the other area attributed to entrepreneurial. So we need to make sure for 1920 we absolutely do not replicate that. So we're certainly doing that work behind the scenes to absolutely make sure that those proposals can actually be delivered in practice, not just by the end of the year, but within timescales in each quarter, because that's also important.
Gary?
I suppose just to reinforce that, and a practical example, Destination Island, a sort of flagship potential project. That's a project where my colleague Leslie Aitken is working with Gary Sherritt's team to go through the detail to really achieve what would be the equivalent of a Green Book standard. That's a Treasury standard for capital investment. That business case, to make sure the numbers are robust, to make sure we fully understand and articulate to elected members what the financial implications are for the council in proceeding with projects such as that. So we're really putting that rigour in, but I absolutely agree with Grace's point that needs to come much more earlier in the process in terms of that initial step. So there's an iterative process from an outline business case through to an absolute final business case, but really bringing that outline business case earlier so we can make informed decisions.
Jill.
Just in response to Councillor Muirhead's question, one of the things that we would like to get to, and it's articulated in the internal audit strategy, is that we work more on a continuous audit basis, and we're moving in that direction. So again, we will be following up these recommendations in relation to the Delivering Excellence programme, but we need to do that as the process evolves and look to see that some of these improvements are indeed coming to fruition, and that we actually do see the benefits of that during the process. So we will again include a piece of work in 1920. This is such a significant area in terms of the change and transformation programme. The other aspect around training and enabling councillors to do the scrutiny, I think there's a number of different elements, both for officers around financial management, budget management, and some of the change around the financial information. So there's probably some requirement for enhancing that within our budget holders. But indeed, if there are any elected members that are on the Business Transformation Steering Group or other forums where these the Delivering Excellence programme is presented, and feel that you need to have more of an understanding about what underpins that, then I think we need to look at maybe different ways of, like we've had earlier on today in terms of a briefing session, just to help and facilitate some of that understanding and enable all our stakeholders to fulfil their responsibilities. So there's maybe a number of different aspects that require as kind of building blocks to underpin some of the areas of improvement.
Councillor Milligan.
Yeah,
my friend Crenna, that would be helpful at all, and I take the point Grace is making. And I think then there's a requirement, perhaps either the Business Transformation Steering Group or the Cabinet or Council or whatever, to be setting timescales where we expect income to have been generated, so that we have monthly reporting to elected members, so that if there's a target for income to be generated, that we know by the end of April, that, or sorry, by the end of May, that it's hitting its target. And it should be the same for any stuff that we're, for example, given efficiency targets, to make sure that if there is an efficiency target in there and we're expecting savings, that it's identified what these efficiencies are, it's identified early, it's identified the amount, and it's identified when and where, so that we'll have a clear picture of what's coming to us. And it's probably to see, well, where do we take that role? Do you take it into Business Transformation, or do you take it into Cabinet, or where is that role? If we're wanting cross-party, it would be Business Transformation. But I think in every budget saving and every area that we're looking at, we should have a sheet maybe coming to every Business Transformation group saying, here's what we see on the 1st of April, here's where we are. To make sure that elected members and other officers are aware exactly what the position is, so that if there is a slippage, then action can be taken either in that area or from another area to make sure that the budgets we've got, that we didn't end up at the end of the year with any overspends.
Yeah, and I think I totally agree, and it's getting into the routine monitoring that we've talked about over the last few audit committees. But I think the important thing about the medium-term financial strategy at the minute, we've got some savings in one programme, other savings in another programme. We need to combine everything into one thing so that we're not duplicating any savings, so it makes it simpler for everybody. So we're just monitoring the one programme, so we know where everything is. And there's something for me about the quarterly report that comes up to council, that should be the end result. It shouldn't be a surprise to anybody, because we should be monitoring it proactively, and actually it should be showing that we're delivering within budget. We should never be in a situation where we're having to create recovery plans in order to recover a situation that then comes back to council at a future date. So it's just making it part and parcel of your everyday management practice.
Councillor Muirhead.
Yeah, coming from an IT background, I'm always really quite sceptical about people coming forward with IT solutions that have got to do everything for you. But I have to say that the things we've seen recently in terms of monitoring, I think, is absolutely critical at all levels right through the council. It's too often the case, I think, that, you know, we set a budget, and I'm talking about for officers right through to councillors, that we set a budget, and we just get on with our work and look to see how it's turned out at the end of the day, whether that's at the end of the quarter, at the end of the half year, or even at the end of the year. And that's no good enough anymore, because that actually means that none of us are doing our jobs right in the interim. It should be available. Information on performance and how we're meeting our targets has to be available to us and much shorter timescales, otherwise it's too late to do anything about it. So I really do see that the things that we're talking about doing now in terms of monitoring as being critical. And so is, I think there are huge opportunities in the way we're looking at the automation side of things as well, where we're not saying again that there's some all-singing, all-dancing system that we can put in that's going to cure all our problems, but we're looking at pinch points, we're looking at key areas where we can say, well, look, we can make a difference in that area, and we can get rid of a whole lot of effort that goes in there unnecessarily by simply introducing a bit of automation in there that takes care of that, and then that in itself will come and be built on later on further down the road with other automation until we've got a proper system that evolves over a period of time, but we get hits all the way along, as opposed to waiting for something that actually never arises and never delivers, which is the case with so many big IT ideas across the piece. So I think they're two really good initiatives that we really need to focus and press ahead with.
Stephen.
Thank you, Chair. A really interesting discussion, and from a governance perspective, I think a really good discussion on the back of Internal Audit's report. I think just to add my tuppence worth, I think there is and it is about building blocks, as Jill said, for me in relation to this process. It's around the assurance over the savings plans at the very beginning. Then it's about the monitoring arrangements that are in place. And then it's obviously the role that internal audit play and how current that role is in terms of how quickly they're in there and doing some live auditing to provide that independent assurance. But it sounds to me, Chair, as if something that might be quite helpful is, and the committee's, I think, if I can be so bold to suggest, the committee's almost asking for an overview of what the governance arrangements are going to be in relation to not only the assurance over the savings plans that are going to come forward, but actually also the monitoring arrangements in relation to those and where those are going to sit, whether that's going to be here, whether that's going to be at the business transformation, so that there's absolute clarity going into the next financial year for the Council about those important governance arrangements around something that is a business imperative.
Is that a dialogue you'll be having with the Chief Executive in the first instance and with Gary?
I mean, it's something that I've commented on, I think, in year one of my appointment around the savings programme and the role of internal audit and the governance arrangements. But actually, I think the discussion today suggests to me that the audit committee would like a paper brought back from management around the governance arrangements.
Yeah, I think an excellent idea, and I think that would be something that's really important to do, and particularly if we're discussing medium-term financial strategy, just making sure that we have everything, governance all agreed within this framework. It may also help just in our routinely bringing the quarterly reporting forward and so on, but absolutely in terms of business transformation, and we've got a meeting tomorrow, whether we want to have a further discussion around that and how that actually operates moving forward, particularly if we're shifting into the domain of a medium-term financial strategy.
Thank you for that contribution. We now move to the Treasury Management Strategy.
So,
Peter Deming.
Could I say that I'm very impressed by the discussions that have taken place, and particularly the internal audit and the joint internal audit has impressed me greatly. The one thing that I have failed to hear, and maybe it's something I shouldn't mention, but I read about it in the Advertiser, that really today the wages really represent a very large percent of the expenditure of the council. And when I was a councillor, we of course had the completely incomprehensible system of no compulsory redundancies, and this really, I hope, is going to be revisited. And I wondered if there is anything that one is willing to say on that issue. Thank you.
I wonder, if, Gary, if you could update us on the factual situation there, and then Councillor Milligan.
We brought forward a report to Council in, my recollection, it was September 2017, with the Council's workforce strategy. And as part of that, we the recommendation to members, which was accepted by Council, was to move to a policy where the Council would aim to avoid compulsory redundancies, and that is a policy framework that we work within this point. So we do not have a new compulsory redundancy policy. It is an endeavour which fulfils our statutory responsibility to avoid compulsory redundancies.
Thank you for that confirmation.
But will there be something in the papers that gives us an idea of what the way forward is?
Kerry?
In respect of the redundancy situation? Sorry,
In respect of the savings that you anticipate from a reduction in the wages cost?
So what will happen is the Council needs to set its 1920 budget by the 11th of March. We'll bring forward the report to Council on the 12th of February. Indeed, it will go to Business Transformation Steering Group and draft tomorrow. That will outline the measures that are coming forward to achieve a balanced budget in light of the financial situation, and that will undoubtedly mean, in some areas of the Council, a reduction in the headcount and therefore a reduction in the overall wage cost. But we are still a growing council. We will see growth in early years, growth in schools, So that there'll be, and I think that goes back to the financial overview report. You'll see the education and health and social care areas where there is a growing demand for services, so there'll be a growth in the employee base, but reductions in other services as savings measures are implemented to address the financial challenge. So parts of the budget and certain employee costs going up, but other parts going down.
Councillor Milligan.
Yeah, I think it's fair to say, though, that we're not going to see a reduction in the amount of people working for us or the reduction in the amount of wages we're paying out. In fact, that's likely to rise, Gary, unless I'm completely miscalculating that, with a 3.5% increase on the table now for other unions, and as I understand it, a kidology 3% for teachers, but if you roll up all the other benefits, around 9% for teachers, the wage bill is just going to go up through the roof, which is part of your £11.5 million problem.
Yep, the inflationary pressures that, and I suppose the earlier years of austerity, the council faced challenging budget settlements, but we had virtually no or very low pay inflation. That situation has changed and changed markedly. This year 3.5%, next year 3% for local government employees. The teachers' annual pay rise is 3% on offer, but there is a restructuring of the pay scales supported by government, which does equate to something like 9.3% increase between when you compare with April 2018 to April to March 2019.
Aye. On that note, shall we pass to Treasury Management? Gary, 5.6.
Thanks, Provost. So we brought to Audit Committee today a draft of the Treasury Management Investment Strategy for next financial year, together with the potential indicators, and it's in draft, subject to ongoing work. And really for Audit Committee's comments to be then fed into Council when it considers the report alongside the budget on the 12th of February. And that's really in accordance with the good governance as detailed in the Treasury Management Code of Practice. But turning to the Treasury report itself, we had a very interesting briefing session this morning at 10 o'clock in terms of going through the papers and a healthy debate around the report on the Treasury position, so I won't rehearse a lot of that. The actual report sets out our current position with loans, that's the borrowing to finance our assets, which the 11th of January was just shy of £231 million, and the investments at that point were £74.364 million. Section 2.2 of the report sets out the future borrowing requirement, and as members grasped earlier, a significant increase in borrowing, which reflects the ambitious capital plans of the Council in terms of housing investment, new build and investment in existing stock, and the General Services capital plan, particularly around the learning estate strategy to support the growth in population, again recognising that the fastest growing council in Scotland. We set out in section 2.3 our borrowing strategy for the remainder of the year. And then in section 2.3 set out the investment strategy, and again we touched on both of those aspects earlier this morning. And the strategy there is really to continue to make sure that we've got that. We look at the longer term position in terms of funding the borrowing, bearing in mind that we're borrowing to fund assets that have got a life of up to 50, 60 years. So that long-term position, securing the historically low PWLB rates in terms of our borrowing portfolio, and investments, as I touched on earlier, really to reinforce that security of investment, liquidity of the investment, and then the return. In terms of borrowing, in terms of our average loans fund rate, as I touched on earlier, we are a very good performer. We've continued to outperform all other councils in Scotland, and we should continue to do that. So that's very effective. And we had a lengthy debate about Treasury, and I suppose that what I would hope to get from that and the discussion at Audit Committee Day is really to focus you on the counterparties that you would recommend to Council, or any changes to the counterparties in terms of the report and the counterparty limits that are there. We set out in the report some benchmarking information around other councils and where their investments are. And the table on page 49 of the agenda just shows the areas where that we were investing in, and just, I suppose, gives members reassurance that we are investing in similar vehicles to other councils across Scotland. The report also highlights an alternative investment strategy, if you like, in terms of the where you've got a guarantee by the HM government, which is the Debt Management Office, and just highlights the returns on that at the time of writing were just around 0.5%, so significantly less than the 1% return that we are getting. We discussed examples of other alternatives earlier on this morning, but certainly didn't pick up from the Audit Committee members present at the briefing that there was any desire broadly or a consensus to look at what we might be described more rewarding but equally more risky investment opportunities. Section 3 then goes on to touch on the prudential indicators, and those are the indicators that SIPFA have devised, which are really the measures that you would ask to look at as elected members in terms of the affordability of that borrowing and the impact of that borrowing. So the extent to which borrowing costs consume revenue budget and housing revenue account, the level of rent that is going towards borrowing, and those indicators are set out in the report, along with the limits around authorised borrowing and the capital financing requirement. Really, I suppose the report is written as a report to Council, and what we'll be asking Council to do is to approve the Treasury Management Investment Strategy, approve the list of permitted investments, adopt the prudential indicators, approve the authorised borrowing limit, and the two policy areas to note around the repayment of loans fund advances in terms of recommendation EF. And in G, we are continuing to look at what flexibilities we have around our loans fund and a loans fund review, and we'll update the Treasury Management and Prudential indicators as that progresses, although that is a very topical and a fast-moving position in terms of the work that's going on across Scotland in terms of flexibilities that the 2016 changes brought, and we'll be discussing that with colleagues from EY later today, I'm sure. A topical issue at the moment, which I won't go into any more detail at present. So really, I suppose, considering what the recommendations are going to be at Council, and I think my reading of your discussion earlier would be around permitted investments and counterparty limits. So happy to take more questions on the report as committee sees fit.
Thank you very much. As you know, we've covered a lot of this ground already. I think the big issues were moving towards a authorised limit of £523 million, a very big increase from just over £300 million at the moment. I wonder, Stephen, if, as Ernst & Young, you have any comment on this extraordinary increase in the likely indebtedness of the Council?
My only comment at this stage is clearly to be concerned with the governance process that the Council is going through, and clearly this is an important part of this, and then approval at Council. I have noted the significant level, an increase in borrowing, you know, as Gary said, linked to HRE and then the estate learning infrastructure, and I'll certainly be making comment on that in my annual report, and it may well feature in the BV report.
Is your concern that our capital expenditure comes in on time and on budget?
Well, I think that's always a concern, not specifically for you as a council, but you know, across local authorities in Scotland and indeed most bodies in Scotland, where there are major capital plans, the risk of increase in slippage because of capacity, capability, supply chain is heightened. So yes, that must be a concern for this council, given the pace and the ramping up of the capital programme going forward.
Councillor Milligan.
Yeah, I think I'll just start with Daniel. Congratulations yet again. We're performing better than 31 other councils, and it sounds a wee bit hollow because I seem to have been repeating that every year for some considerable time now. So, but it is genuinely meant. I do accept that we need to be critical of the need to increase your borrowing, but the reality is your school estate is urgently needing expanded. We have a 13.5% growth in Midlothian, and we are really struggling to have the school capacity in there. We have a very, very ambitious social housing programme, which the cost to the council in no completing will be even more expensive for having to put folk in bed and breakfasts and temporary accommodations, which either this council or somebody else for the public purse can end up quite often paying the price of that. So it's really important that we ramp these stuff up. There is the chicken and egg scenario with that, because we have areas of constraint where we would like to get on with building, but we don't have the schools for the kids to go to. So we'll have that kind of problem. It's identifying land for schools for that. If you take, for example, the HS10 site in Botherick, where we had asked for additionality for school space, the appeal went to the Scottish Government, taken right out of their hands, granted no school, no ground for school and no conditions for a school, just a contribution. So we then have to run to look to build or redevelop one of your existing schools, which adds to your problem. So I do think that we have problems with. I take the slippage in the capital plan stuff. If you look, for example, some of the savings we're looking for our new council depot and the slippage in time, again, some of it's not in our hands because it's due to the planning processes and having to go through the public engagements and stuff like that. However, it's something we need to be very much aware of. The question, I think, that was foremost in people's minds today, Gary, was the risk associated around our investments and returns and what that risk was for the return. And there was some suggestions that other councils limit where deposits can be made to for internal British banks that have come with a guarantee. But if memory serves us right, we talked about these having a lot lower returns. And indeed, I think at the worst case scenario, if we invested with government, we were talking about a 0.5% return, which would have cost us in excess of £350,000 in the revenue account a year. Is there worth putting something and the paper that goes forward identifying what the scenarios are, what risks are mitigated by that, but what costs are incurred by that?
So we've really already covered that in the report that's in front of members. There is the section that just highlights the alternative funding strategy in terms of reserves. The Debt Management Office, and that's £344,000 was what we got to based on the investments we're holding at the 11th of January. There was talk at the Audit Committee briefing session around the West Lothian Treasury Management Strategy about only permitting investments in UK domicile banks, I think was the terminology. We've checked West Lothian's Treasury Management Strategy this morning. I'm looking at it, and it's various. It's exactly the same as ours. Indeed, West Lothian have you know, there was discussion this morning about the investment in terms of the notice account with Goldman Sachs. It's a vehicle that West Lothian have used. So we're very, very similar in terms of that. But I'm happy between now and the final report going to council, my colleague Gary Thompson will do a bit more work just to look at any opportunities to tweak our treasury management strategy in terms of what West Lothian have got. We're advised by the same people. We're audited by the same people. So I don't think there is a great gulf between where we are and what we're doing in terms of operating within the permitted investments and what West are doing.
Wasn't the impression I got when I spoke to them. We go back to if it's a UK institution, something was to go wrong, we're not in a position to take any risk with principal whatsoever here. But if something did go wrong, we would have the UK government, at least as the regulator, likely to produce a solution. Whereas if it's an international entity, such as Goldman Sachs, the situation might be very much more difficult, as it was with Lehman Brothers.
Yeah, well, our investment in Goldman Sachs, it is a domicile bank. It will operate under the same protection mechanisms as any other UK bank, other than those that are the nationalised banks, but we've seen the government pulling back from nationalised banks. And as Councillor Hardy rightly pointed out, that the recompense, if there is default, is in terms of the level of investments is very low. And I suppose, you know, going back, the risk attached through the rating agencies and the work that Link do assess the risk around the risk of default on those investments, and all of the rating agencies and the work that Link do highlight that risk is extremely low. There is a risk. There is never a guarantee. The only guarantee you've got absolutely is probably the Debt Management Office, although I'm sure, depending where Brexit goes and other things, there is probably still risks around UK government. Indeed, the rating agencies, I think, where Brexit pushed the rating of UK government down a bit. But again, it comes back to the audit committee really, and then recommending to council if you want to change where the permitted investments sit. But certainly, I'll take on board between now and a council meeting to review West Lothian to make sure if there's anything we can learn from that or any tweaks that we can make.
You mentioned the credit reference agencies which Link will use, and you quote Fitch, but there are several, for example, that cover Goldman Sachs, and they don't always give the same result.
No, and the credit rating agencies, Fitch, Standard and Poor's and Moody's, Link will use all of those, and will also overlay a number of other measures. It's quite a complicated process that we'll go through. And they have the expertise and the capacity to do that work, and that's part of the contract that we have with them. That they come up with their credit criteria and regularly assess that, and we get daily updates in terms of the various the criteria and all of the counterparties.
So the message from you, Gary, is that your door is open if there starts to be within the councillor group some idea of creating some extra governance of the choice of the counterparties.
Yeah, I would caution that, because what we need to be able to do is have a governance framework and a policy framework that allows us to then operationally on a daily basis make the decisions. The Treasury markets are very fast moving. We may only get very limited windows to secure an investment and place deposits. And what I wouldn't be able to do is build delay into that system. You know, we couldn't be in a position where we have to wait 6 weeks to get council decision because things will have moved on. So we definitely need that governance framework from you as a committee in terms of what's permitted. With the work of audit and the work of the committee as well in terms of reports come back, you've got that framework where you can assess performance against that to make sure we're doing what you've permitted. But we need to have that operational capacity to go and do the deals sometimes on a very, very short turnaround period.
Thank you. Well, I think possibly for Jill to note, you've certainly had lots of challenge on this over the years on the question of our counterparties. I'll leave it with the other councillors as to whether they form a view. There being no further comments, can I thank you all for coming?